Vladimir Putin is now focused on capturing eastern Ukraine, a largely Russian-speaking part of the nation. The Kremlin made one big assumption. Those Ukrainians want to be Russians. Some diplomats say that's plain wrong.
They didn't want to be a part of Russia. They don't want to be a part of Russia.
Also, what it's like for a reporter to interview Ukraine's President Zelensky in his bunker.
Inside, there were a lot of snipers, a lot of sandbags. We went into a building down some steps. It got dark. We had to leave our phones at the door, anything that could give away our location.
I'm Carol Hills. Plus, 5,000 years ago, ancient Europeans had some all-too-modern instincts.
That's got to do with staking claims to territory, marking your place in the land.
We go back to the age of Stonehenge this hour. Those stories and robot dogs ahead on the world. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Yesterday, there was talk of peace. Ukrainian and Russian officials met in Turkey to chart a path forward out of war. Today, more Russian missiles and shelling. Ukrainian authorities say attacks continued around the capital, Kyiv, and in the northern city of Chernihiv, two areas where Russia yesterday vowed to reduce combat operations. We want to talk about the delicate balance in these peace talks, so we got in touch with former U.S. ambassador to both Russia and Ukraine, John Teft. Ambassador, what about yesterday's peace talks did you find to be actually encouraging?
Well, I'm always encouraged when there's people talking to try to stop the violence and stop the killing. But I have to say, when I first saw it in the morning, when I got up, I said to myself, I'm dubious. And then, of course, I read what Tony Blinken, our Secretary of State, said, and he expressed a lot of skepticism. And that seemed to me the right reaction. I was struck in going over this morning some of the Russian commentary that apparently after Mr. Medinsky, who was the chief negotiator on the Russian side in Istanbul, made his statement and was fairly upbeat, there was a pretty sharp, small but significant group of people in Russia who reacted very negatively to this on social media. They wanted to keep the fight going. They wanted to take Kyiv. They believe in the denazification, this crazy line that Putin continues to use. And of course, this morning we've seen the Kremlin spokesman kind of backpedaling. There were no breakthroughs at all. And then, as you say, there have been all of these military attacks. I remain skeptical that Putin will ever find a way to accommodate the continuation of an independent democratic government inside of Ukraine.
How damaging is it to the future of these peace talks when Russia continues to strike areas it says at the table that it will stop targeting?
Well, I think it just makes the point that President Biden and I think President Zelensky said yesterday that there's just no trust there. It's the sole decision maker ultimately in Russia is Putin, as we all know. And I'm at least very skeptical that he's ready to make these compromises that are necessary. Zelensky said, we're ready to look at the possibility of a neutral Ukraine. But he said, we're not going to compromise on sovereignty and territorial integrity of the country. Well, that's exactly what Putin wants. So anyway, I'm in the skeptical group.
I mean, as you mentioned, President Zelensky has dangled neutrality out there, and he said that everything is on the table for discussion. What do you think the Russians are prepared to talk about or concede? Is there anything they're willing to compromise on?
It may be that they have given up the plan to try to seize Kyiv and to bring down the government, which clearly was the initial goal. But I think if you've watched the military actions over the last few weeks, you've seen slowly but surely this effort to try to consolidate what is known as the land bridge. They've moved troops out of the Crimea, and they want to be able to link Crimea that way to the Donbas. This is why Mariupol is so important. They want to be able to control Mariupol so that they control the Black Sea shore. I myself am skeptical that the Ukrainians would ever agree to something like this.
How important is the day-to-day fighting on the ground in terms of how it affects what each side is prepared to talk about?
We don't know for sure how Putin reacts to the casualties. And I saw new numbers this morning that have the Russian war dead at, 15,000. Several estimates have it on the high end. I'm not sure we know for sure because the Russians haven't even taken the bodies of their dead soldiers back with them. And I think that people are going to say, for what? For what have we done this? Why? That's going to take some time. I don't think it's they've shut off the all of the independent news. There is stuff getting through on the internet. So Putin is not someone who cares, as we've seen in his earlier campaigns in Chechnya and in Syria. He's not someone who cares about human life. I don't think Vladimir Putin is going to give up on his lifelong goal of trying to restore the Russian Empire and, for, in his view, Ukraine, and control politically and militarily of Ukraine is critical.
John Taft, you were ambassador to Ukraine and then later your ambassador to Russia. What did you learn during that time that you think is overlooked as the world watches these peace talks?
I think one of the fundamental points, and the last 3 months I was in Ukraine in 2013, I had visited Donetsk and Lugansk, and I've been in Odessa, Mykolaiv, Kherson, and a lot of these places that are in the news today for all of this fighting that's been going on. And I found at that time that the people down there didn't want to be a part of Russia. There was a myth, I think, in the minds of Russian leaders that somehow these people spoke Russian and they wanted to be a part of Russia. In fact, what you've had built up in Ukraine over the last 30 years is what Professor Timothy Snyder of Yale calls civic national consciousness. You've got a real commitment to building a nation of democracy and economy. And I don't think Russia has ever understood that. They look at this through a very warped prism. This came through to me clearly when I got to Moscow in September of 2014. When I started talking to a lot of people privately as I made my introductory calls, and you could understand that this myth was there. They were talking about this land bridge and how it was so important in these Russian lands to free these people and let them be a part of a new kind of new Russia. And I thought it was wrong then, and I told them that privately, and I think it's still wrong today.
Do you think Ukraine can make the Russians see that at the negotiation table?
I think it goes against this very entrenched myth that many in the Russian leadership and throughout their society have had. I've traveled a number of times when I was ambassador in Ukraine to Kharkiv. Although everybody was speaking in Russian, these people were Ukrainian patriots. They didn't want to be a part of Russia. And I think that says everything about the desire and the spirit of the Ukrainian people. Their desire, they'd be happy to live with Russia, to trade with Russia, but they do not want to be a part of Russia. They want to be a part of an independent Ukraine.
Bottom line, what do you think is the best way to end this war quickly?
I think we have to continue to support Ukraine. I think the only thing that Russia in the end will understand is losing or being defeated in different parts of the battlefield there. This is about Ukraine fundamentally, but it's also about larger values. It's about the right of people to choose their own future. As I saw when I was ambassador in Georgia, ceasefires just become permanent and the Russians don't really honor the agreement. So there's something that has to be watched carefully there as well.
John Taft is a former U.S. ambassador to both Russia and Ukraine. Ambassador, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Today, some positive news to report in U.S.-Russian relations.
Touchdown.
NASA astronaut Mark Vandehei arrived back on Earth today after 355 days on the International Space Station. He hitched a ride with two Russian cosmonauts, two nations that are enemies on Earth at the moment, but partners in space. Can that continue? Brian Whedon is with the Secure World Foundation, a program that works with governments to promote the peaceful use of space. Brian, remind us how far back Russian-U.S. space cooperation goes.
It goes back a couple of decades. But we also need to remember that it wasn't always cooperative. The U.S.-Soviet space relationship started in the 1960s in a very competitive manner. And it wasn't until the 1990s, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, when we started a more cooperative approach to Russia in space. And that was a deliberate policy choice by the U.S. government. And that has really been the framing for the relationship, at least for the last few decades.
Why are Russia and the U.S. partnered at the International Space Station?
The Clinton administration came up with the idea of bringing Russia in. And really, there was a national security foreign policy aspect of that. It was about not only trying to build a better, more friendlier relationship with Russia through the space program, but also keeping the Russian scientists and engineers busy working on, you know, space for peaceful purposes and scientific purposes, rather than potentially building bad things for bad people.
What are the American obligations and commitments in space towards Russia's space program and its astronauts?
The U.S.-Russia relationship at the moment is primarily through the space station itself. And in that, both U.S. and Russia have different responsibilities. The first module that went up was the Russian Zarya module, and it serves as sort of the main propulsion hub for the space station. It's how they keep reboosting it up. The U.S. has a couple of modules, and at the moment, one of those is the primary power hub for the International Space Station. And it's really that sort of division between propulsion and power that makes the U.S. and Russia sort of joined at the hip when it comes to operating the International Space Station.
And of course, today, American astronaut Mark VandeHei was brought back to Earth. Nothing's going on yet. They're all working together. But how might the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the deteriorating Russian-U.S. relationship ultimately affect the International Space Station?
So far, the space station has managed to go on. And we've got to remember, this is not the first Russian invasion of Ukraine. Despite that, in 2014 and the several years since, the International Space Station has remained relatively solid. I think both countries have had a strong interest in keeping it going because both really have no other choice at this point when it comes to the International Space Station. For me, I think the real question is what happens next.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, I mean, Russian-U.S. relations are really at a low point, and there's a lot of tension. Are you worried about the International Space Station?
I'm not worried about the International Space Station at the moment because I think both countries still have very strong incentives to not screw that up. The question is what comes next. There is an ongoing discussion about extending the space station. Right now, it's really only agreed to among all the partners to operate it through 2024. There is a push to extend it to 2028 or 2030. I think that is going to be politically difficult for the U.S. to say, yes, we are going to continue to partner with the Russians for the next 8 years. At the moment, it looks like there's probably not going to be a firm U.S.-Russia relationship beyond the International Space Station.
Ultimately, space cooperation between nations has been about putting humanity's best foot forward. Does today's touchdown remind us of that?
I think it does, right? Given all the things that are going on, all the you know, Twitter disputes, battles back and forth, and the invectives, we still have cooperation between a couple of countries who are at loggerheads in bringing back a human being from space safely. I think that is, you know, at least one bright spot.
Brian Whedon is the Director of Program Planning for the Secure World Foundation. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Several attacks in Israel over the last week have police there on high alert. That story is just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. A Palestinian gunman shot and killed 5 people last night in an Israeli town outside of Tel Aviv. It was the 3rd deadly attack in Israel in the past week. Daniela Cheslow is a reporter with the AFP news agency in Jerusalem. She's on the line with me now. Daniela, this attack last night was carried out by a man with an assault rifle. What happened?
Carol, I went this morning to Bnei Brak, where the shooting happened. It's an ultra-Orthodox city outside Tel Aviv, and people there were getting ready for funerals. That's the sound of a car blasting directions for the funeral of Yaakov Israel Shalom. He was one of 4 civilians killed in last night's attack before police shot the attacker, who killed an officer before he died. A 65-year-old graphic designer told me he saw on security cameras of his own building a man with an M16 rifle running in the stairwell. He said he didn't know how he was alive, and he cried as we spoke. There were candles lit outside a mini market where 2 Ukrainians had been shot dead last night. One Ukrainian woman who lit a candle was a friend of one of the victims, and she said they had all come from Ukraine a few years ago to work in Israel. And she told me at this point she doesn't know Israel, Ukraine, where it's safe.
There were 2 other attacks in recent days. A total of 11 victims are dead, not including the attackers who were shot and killed. Israeli police are now on high alert. What do we know about why this is happening right now?
Well, it's not clear what is behind all these attacks. Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett says Israel stands before a, quote, wave of murderous Arab terrorism. And Israelis will say it's a result of incitement and extremism. But there are also practical factors. For years, Arab citizens of Israel, they're about 20% of the population, have complained there are too many weapons in their towns, and they've asked Israeli authorities to crack down, they say, with no result. And also, Palestinians say there are deep grievances that keep on burning. Israel's military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is in its 45th year. There are no negotiations right now, and Bennett has said he doesn't believe in a two-state solution to the conflict.
How are Palestinian leaders responding to the news of these attacks?
It has been varied. The Hamas Islamic group that rules the Gaza Strip called it heroic. The president of the Palestinian Authority based in Ramallah, Mahmoud Abbas, condemned the attack, and he said permanent, comprehensive, and just peace is the shortest way to provide security and stability for the Palestinian and Israeli peoples. But these attacks are also happening as an Arab party for the first time is a part of the Israeli governing coalition. The leader of that party, Mansour Abbas, has condemned the attacks, although opposition in Israel, including the former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, says the government cannot handle terrorism while it has an Islamist party at the table.
Last question, Daniela. The Muslim holy month of Ramadan begins in a few days, and this year it also coincides with both the Jewish holiday of Passover and the Easter holiday for Christians. What do these attacks mean for these celebrations in the Holy Land this year?
This means more people are going to be trying to get to holy sites in Jerusalem, including the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, as Muslims call it, and the Temple Mount, as Jews refer to it, in the heart of the Old City. Remember, last year it was clashes at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound during Ramadan that fueled in part an 11-day conflict between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. And Israel this year was trying to get ahead of that by issuing thousands of work permits for people from Gaza, and Jordan's King Abdullah visited Palestinian leaders in the West Bank this week and then received Israel's defense minister and president in Jordan. But this latest round of violence threatens to pull those efforts off the rails. Already, even more centrist members of Bennett's government are talking about more law enforcement. Defense Minister Benny Gantz today said he was deploying 1,000 troops to beef up Israeli police work, and he said he was willing to call up thousands of reservists to end this wave of attacks.
Daniela Cheslow is a reporter with the AFP News Agency in Jerusalem. Thanks, Daniela.
Thank you, Carol.
By now, it's an all-too-familiar setting. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky in a green T-shirt, sitting behind a desk in a bunker somewhere in Kyiv. Many have seen the image in videos. Few have actually been inside the bunker to meet Zelensky.
Inside, there were a lot of snipers, a lot of sandbags. We went into a building down some steps. It got dark. We had to leave our phones, devices, electronics, pens at the door, anything that could give away our location.
That's Zanny Minton-Beddoes, editor-in-chief of The Economist. Last Friday, with her colleague Arkady Ostrovsky, they met President Zelensky in Kyiv. Portions of their interview can be heard on an upcoming episode of The Economist Asks podcast. Arkady Ostrovsky is Russia and Eastern Europe editor of The Economist. He joins me now. You and your boss, Zanny Minton-Beddoes, talked to Zelensky for more than an hour. What parts of the interview made the strongest impression on you?
The most interesting thing was Zelensky was not doing any act. He was acting very genuinely and authentically. One of the most extraordinary answers, I thought, was his answer about what victory meant to him. And he thought for quite a few seconds before he gave the answer. And his answer was the victory means basically survival. Victory means saving as many Ukrainian lives as possible. And this is the president, I think this is absolutely at the essence of his presidency, is that he's focused on people, not land. He is focused on humanity, not state.
Of course, what Zelensky wants to do is end this war, and he's been emphatic about the problem of controlling Ukrainian airspace from the beginning of the war. Here's part of his response when you asked what his top priority is right now.
Number one, airplanes. Number two, but it's number one, tanks,
armored vehicles.
Yes, we don't have it so much as we need.
One of the striking things about this interview is that Zelensky never pretended that his role is to command Ukrainian forces. He leaves that to his generals. He is not ordering his people to do anything. He is actually as he put it himself, he is a representative of his people. You know, he is a spokesman for his people. He doesn't make decisions for them. They're telling Zelensky what they want to do, and I think he is supporting them.
Zelensky has been giving speeches to governments around the world. He's been speaking with journalists like you one-on-one, issuing daily videos. His presence is everywhere. You follow Russia closely. Compare that to how Vladimir Putin is conducting himself as the Russian leader in this war.
Well, it couldn't be more different. I mean, it's fundamentally different type of power. Vladimir Putin is now a dictator. Vladimir Putin has been sitting in his bunker, not just for the past 2 years, as Zelensky put it, but for the past two decades. I mean, the gap between him and the people has grown wider and wider. I mean, he is a very traditional Russian autocrat who believes that his authority lies in mystery and in violence. It's a fundamentally different type of leadership.
Given how Vladimir Putin is conducting himself and how he's isolating himself from his own people, how do we measure Russian public support for the war and for Putin himself?
I don't think we can. At the moment, measuring people's opinions of Putin or of war is impossible because you don't know what you're actually measuring. All you're really measuring in these circumstances is the amount of time people are exposed to this propaganda and nothing else. You know, if there is ceasefire, when the effects of sanctions become more obvious, then we might be able to get some measure of it. But at the moment, all we're measuring is just the television time.
Arkady Ostrovsky is Russia and Eastern Europe editor at The Economist. He met in person and interviewed Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky in Kyiv on March 25th. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Nearly 80 years ago, a Jewish composer was killed in the Holocaust. The opera he wrote was never heard, but his composition made it out of Germany.
The trunk ended up in the basement of our house in San Francisco, and I knew that there was an opera in there.
So what did his granddaughter do with that opera? That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In southern Ukraine, Russian forces continue to bombard the port city of Mariupol. The city's mayor, Vadim Boychenko, is calling it a humanitarian catastrophe. People there lack electricity and access to food and water. For the latest on the situation, we're joined now by Ukrainian reporter Volodymyr Solohub. He's in Zaporizhia in southern Ukraine. Volodymyr, what's the situation like in Mariupol today?
Carol, the situation in Mariupol is very dire. I came to Zaporizhia a few days ago, which is basically a logistics hub for those fleeing the fighting in Mariupol and other places in eastern and southern Ukraine. And those people that are getting out of that area, out of that fighting, they describe it as living through hell. Most of them had to shelter in their basements, in bomb shelters for weeks, and then endure a very dangerous road from their towns, from the places where they were staying during the fighting, here to safety in Zaporizhia.
Do we have a sense of the number of casualties in Mariupol since the war began?
The mayor of Mariupol said that at least 5,000 people died since the beginning of the war. But this number is a very conservative figure. From what I'm hearing from the locals in Mariupol, a lot of them, they had to bury their relatives and loved ones right in their backyards, on the ground, in the school where they were sheltering. And those that were leaving the city, they said they saw bodies laying on the streets. So I think this figure is way below the real death toll in Mariupol these days.
I know you've spoken with evacuees from Mariupol. What have they told you about the situation in the city, what it was like before they left?
Yes, everybody I've been talking to, they have some sort of horrific story. A few days ago, I spoke to Artur and Natalia. They had a harrowing journey from Mariupol to safety here in Zaporizhia. They are a relatively young couple in their early 30s with three small kids. during this entire month, they were living in the school, which they were sharing with 250 other people. And the rockets and the shelling was very close to where they were staying.
In любой момент, раз прилетел град, попал в здание этой школы.
So, Carol, what Arthur is saying is that they had to stay in the school with other people, and because they did not have any access to food or water, they had to cook outside. And because it was so dangerous to cook outside, only he and his brother-in-law were brave enough to go out there and cook for these 250 people.
Воды нет, электричества нет, связи нет, снег выпал, это если бы снег.
So, Carol, what Arthur is explaining about their conditions is that there was no electricity, there was no heating, there was no running water. So what they were forced to do was to go outside, gather snow, melt it, to have some sort of drinking water or cooking water.
Wow, it's unbelievable. So how are Arthur and Natalia finally able to get out of Mariupol?
Carol, I asked exactly the same question, and here's what they told me. So what Arthur is saying is that there were 11 people in their car, 5 kids and 6 adults. He also said that they were forced to sleep in the car altogether because there was no other safe place for them to stay overnight. Arthur also told me that crossing between Mariupol and Zaporizhia, Ukraine-controlled territory, they had to pass through numerous checkpoints. Some of them were manned by Russian regular army. And at one of the checkpoints, his brother-in-law went under rigorous scrutiny, and he was detained for several days. He was eventually released, but he was beaten up and pretty shaken, Carol.
So now that Arthur and Natalia are in Zaporizhia, what's going to happen to them?
For many of those crossing into Zaporizhia, this is just a transit point. So they can get some rest. They can go to shelter, to sleep. They can get some food. They can even get clothes, because many of those people had very little time to pack and have very little or no clothing at all. And for Arthur and Natalia, as for many other evacuees that I spoke to, they don't even know what's going to happen to them next. There are various options. Some people take trains that are free of charge and go to western parts of Ukraine. Others try to cross the border into Poland or other neighboring countries. But as I said, Carol, those people are so shaken up that once they reach Zaporizhia, this is such a relief for them. And a lot of them were telling me that once they crossed the first Ukrainian checkpoint, they were crying.
What about the people remaining in Mariupol? Are they effectively trapped in the city at this point?
Absolutely. There is no indication that the fighting will stop. The ceasefire for humanitarian corridors hasn't been working for the past weeks. So all those that are still trying to leave and that are leaving, they're doing this at their own risk. And as I said, they're almost doing this without any access to information because they don't have access to internet. And basically, the information is just passed by word of mouth about when to go out, when it's safe, and what are the best routes to get out of Mariupol.
When you speak with Mariupol evacuees in Zaporizhia, do they say whether they'll return to their city when the war's over?
Actually, it's 50-50. Some of those who love their city so much, they wish to return. They're still hopeful that once the war is over, they will be able to go back. They will be able to rebuild and live in their city. Others think that they will never come back because they say there will be nothing to go back to.
Volodymyr Solohub is a Ukrainian journalist. He spoke with us from Zaporizhia, Ukraine, where he's been speaking with evacuees from Mariupol. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, a tragic story with a moment of enduring triumph. In 1943, the Jewish composer Eugen Engel was murdered at the Sobibor extermination camp. His opera, Greta Minde, was never heard. But 8 decades later, it's now being performed for the first time at a theater in Germany. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
Eugen Engel wasn't a professional musician. He was actually a buyer of fabric for women's coats. But music was his passion. His masterpiece was an opera, Greta Minde. Engel worked on it in his spare time, and it took him 20 years. but he finally finished in 1933, the year Hitler seized power. Engel had some contacts in the music world, and he wrote them letter after letter trying to get his opera produced, but he was a Jew in Germany in the 30s, and there was no way. Meanwhile, Engel's daughter, Eva Lowen, managed to escape to the U.S., and in 1941, Engel gave her his music for safekeeping. He tried to follow her to the States, but he didn't make it out. Eva kept the music in a trunk for years, remembers her daughter, Jan Agee.
The trunk ended up in the basement of our house in San Francisco, and I knew that there was an opera in there.
But Eva never took it out, as far as Jan knew.
It was very hard for my mother to talk about any of it. And she was always very upset that she had been able to leave, but that my grandfather hadn't.
After Eva died in 2006, Jan started going through her grandfather's papers. She found letters, some chamber music he had written, and the score for Grete Minde. Eventually, through a friend of a friend, the score ended up in the hands of Anna Skrileva, the music director of the Magdeburg Theater in East Germany.
First, I've got a copy of the piano score. I played it through, and I was very impressed about the quality of this melodic and harmonic language.
The opera is about a woman, Grete Minde, who was cheated out of her inheritance. She takes revenge by burning down the town.
You can hear the fire at the end, when the whole city is just burning. The melodies and the harmonic language is very, very similar to Richard Wagner.
She says Eugen Engel loved German culture and felt a deep connection to it.
He felt himself just a normal German man because he loved Germany, and you can hear it in the music.
Skrileva says she's thought a lot about the letters Eugen Engel was writing in 1936 and 37. It was a time when many Jews in Germany were writing letters to anyone they knew, desperately searching for a way out of the country.
But Eugen Engel, he was not trying to save his life. He was writing letters and trying to find the possibility to perform his opera. This is, for me, how to explain it? I mean, music and his piece was more important than his life.
On opening night of Grete Minde, Jan Agee was in the audience.
It got a standing ovation. People were stomping their feet. And people were also very moved.
Jan, of course, was thinking about her mom.
It's one of my greatest regrets that my mother didn't live long enough to know that the opera was performed, and my grandfather never had the opportunity to hear it. In the end, I was lucky because he's now being recognized.
But she says there are so many others who died, whose music, whose art was lost forever. Jan says maybe this opera can be for them, too. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
The final performance of Grete Minde will be on April 3rd. It's a fundraiser for the victims of the war in Ukraine. The mysteries around Stonehenge have been with us for centuries, but an exhibit at the British Museum looks beyond the monument itself to the era in which it was built. The museum describes this period of ancient history as a restless and highly connected age. Neil Wilkin is the lead curator, and he time-traveled to 3000 BCE with the world's Marco Werman to describe the age of Stonehenge.
the time that the monument's built 5,000 years ago is one of early farmers. This is a time when the hunter-gatherer population that used to live in Britain since the last ice age, believe it or not, are replaced by these farming communities, and they bring a new way of life. Domesticated animals, which they keep, crops, which they farm. And it's a big break from what's come before, when people were living much more in tune with nature rather than controlling nature. So it's those first farmers who build the first monuments. That's got to do with staking claims to territory, marking your place in the land, a really different attitude to nature than the one that came before.
So the exhibition includes stone axes from the Italian Alps and a thing called the Nebra Sky Disc. What is that?
We've got these beautiful jade axes that are quarried in the high Alps in northern Italy. And they're brought with these first farming communities, who are the people who build the first Stonehenge. And so those axes represent these new people coming into Britain, and also these new ideas that they're bringing. And really, those new ideas involve changing the landscape, building monuments like Stonehenge, but also clearing woodland for the first time. And then you mentioned the Nebra Sky Disc. That's an astonishing object, 3,600 years old, from Germany. What that is a bronze and gold disc about the size of a dinner plate, and it's encoded with a range of astronomical information about the solstices, so the longest and shortest day of the year, information about the leap year that you need to add to synchronize your lunar and solar calendar, and also a representation of the Pleiades, which is a cluster of seven stars, sometimes called the Seven Sisters, that's really important for farming communities as a marker of the beginning and the end of the farming year. And the reason we've got it in the show is that it represents what happens when metal appears in Britain and Europe, which is people stop building monuments like Stonehenge and they start using bronze and gold as a representation of this information that used to be encoded within stone circles. It's now on a portable object that individuals, leaders of society, priests and so on, can possess, can own. So it's a major shift in social hierarchy, in religion and in society.
I mean, this was a long, long time ago. So what insights do you think the Age of Stonehenge might hold for us today in the 21st century? What should visitors to the British Museum consider?
One is how connected people were during a time where there were no roads. There's a human desire for connection between people. And that's something that coronavirus has made us realize that we need. And that's something that Stonehenge represents, place of gathering. There's a second point, and that's the sophistication of the time. We tend to think about this period as one that's primitive and simple, but a lot of the objects are extraordinary. So it really puts us into perspective. I think those are things that I hope people take away from the exhibition if they visit.
Neil Wilkin at the British Museum, lead curator for the exhibit The World of Stonehenge. Thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
A British woman who rode solo from the Canary Islands to Barbados has broken a world record. Victoria Evans completed the journey across the Atlantic Ocean and down to the Caribbean in 41 days. It was about 3,000 miles and included some brutal conditions.
Week three has not been ideal. It's been very intense living aboard a boat in 4 meter swell and up to 27 knots of wind.
That's Evans reporting from her one-woman boat.
I've got over-fatigued and got shingles, which is really not ideal on expedition.
She spent 4 years training for this journey, but before that, she had almost no experience rowing. In fact, Evans told Sky News that growing up, she wasn't athletic at all. She didn't get into sports until her mid-20s.
It was at a point in life where I endured a reasonable amount of adversity and suffered with issues as a result of that adversity. I had an eating disorder for a long time and depression, and sport has been transformational for me in overcoming those.
Evans is 35 years old. In normal life, she's a sports lawyer. She says the point of her expedition was to raise awareness about how powerful women can be. Here she is speaking from Barbados.
I can't think of many challenges harder than what I've just completed, and to do that alone and as a woman, I really hope that any woman or girl that sees that realises that just anything is possible for them and that those opportunities are there if you're willing to put in the hard work.
That was British athlete Victoria Evans, who just rode 3,000 miles solo and broke a world record. If you want to look at a success story for cutting smoking rates, look to Brazil. One of its winning strategies, banning the sale of electronic devices used for smoking. But now tobacco companies are pressuring the Brazilian government for more flexible regulation. Reporter Theo Ruprecht looked into the possible implications. He began his reporting by trying to find the illegal items for sale in São Paulo.
São Paulo's central district is noisy and crowded, with a mixture of historical sites, abandoned buildings, and squares occupied by homeless people. Shops and vendors line the streets. I ask a street vendor if he has his cigarettes for sale. He guides me through the streets until we reach a small shopping center. Inside, a store displays different e-cigarettes. Two men assist me. The first vendor says that nicotine is addictive, but it doesn't kill you. And since some e-cigarettes don't use the tobacco itself, only a fluid with nicotine and other substances, it wouldn't harm me, he says, incorrectly. The salesman showed the different models without seeming worried about a police raid. And that's one of the reasons some people argue that e-cigarettes should be legalized in Brazil. If people can find them on the streets and on the internet, why prohibit them? They say that without the ban, at least we could regulate the market and tax the sales. But Stella Bialos disagrees. She's a Brazilian expert on tobacco issues and a professor from the University of California at San Francisco.
Because once the product is legally allowed to be distributed, it gets into the distribution network of the tobacco companies, and which is one of the best distribution.
In 2019, less than 1% of Brazilians used e-cigarettes, mostly in large urban areas. Legalization, however, could boost these rates rapidly, since it would make access easier in other parts of the country. Now regarding what the first vendor said about e-cigarettes being harmless. It's simply not true. Nicotine is associated with cardiovascular problems, and the other chemical compounds could be carcinogenic. Still, e-cigarettes may be less harmful than regular cigarettes, although independent studies are inconclusive on that matter so far. Bialos says that still doesn't mean they're safe.
So I think there is a very subtle difference in something that is being less harmful than cigarettes might mean very little because, you know, there's barely any other consumer product out there that kills up to half of its users when used as intended.
But if there's a possibility of harm reduction, why not grab it? That's another argument used by the tobacco companies, which manufacture e-cigarettes now, and also by Fernando Landucci. He is a 34-year-old entrepreneur in São Paulo who switched from regular cigarettes to an electronic device in 2017.
No primeiro mês que eu fiquei zerado de cigarro, primeiro mês que eu não fumei nada.
I felt a huge difference 1 month after I stopped smoking the conventional cigarette. I became someone else, he says. But studies are showing that most e-cigarette consumers are not adults trying to quit smoking. They are teenagers and young adults.
In Brazil, the national survey showed that 70% of the users of the electronic device are between 15 and 24 years old, and most of them have never used conventional cigarettes before.
That's Monica Andres, the executive director from ACT Promoção da Saúde, an NGO that focuses on tobacco control policies.
And considering that these products are attractive to youth and that we can affirm that they really work for tobacco cessation, we believe that we must prioritize the public policies to prevent smoke initiation and also to promote health for Brazilian population.
In 2019, a study did show benefits of e-cigarettes for smoking cessation, but the participants were accompanied in a strict medical setting. And two recent large studies didn't associate e-cigarettes with a higher chance of quitting tobacco products at a populational level. Andrei says that Brazil already has a smoking cessation program with scientifically effective treatments, so there wouldn't be a need for devices that haven't shown their potential yet.
I think that Brazil has a leadership role in Latin America and also around the world related with tobacco control policies. So I believe that the decision from Anvisa and the decision in Brazil has the potential to influence other decisions.
The Federal Health Agency Anvisa preferred not to comment because it is still analyzing the data. In a statement published in February for the website G1, however, the agency stated that, up to this point, there are still uncertainties and controversies related to the risks attributed to these devices. For the world, I'm Telmo Prest in São Paulo, Brazil.
Robots can be found everywhere these days, in our homes, factories, hospitals, and now this place.
Pompeii, buried by Mount Vesuvius.
Documentaries tell the story from the year 79 AD, when a volcano erupted and destroyed the Roman city. The deadly ash and lava wound up preserving the streets, buildings, even the bodies of Romans trapped in Pompeii that day. By day, tourists flock through the city's excavated buildings and byways, getting a view of first-century Roman life. By night, the historic ruins are patrolled by this robot. In a demo video, you can see it move on four legs, watch it walk, run, or fetch, just like a dog. In fact, the manufacturer, Boston Dynamics, named its robot Spot.
It's just under 3 feet high and weighs 70 pounds. A lot of the movements you're seeing here are remote controlled by an operator, but Spot has a handful of basic skills it can do automatically. It knows how to climb stairs, how to avoid walls, and even knows how to dance a little.
Spot's moves are now under the control of engineers at the Archaeological Park of Pompeii. After the tourists leave, Spot is sent out to inspect the fragile ruins and restoration sites. Its optical and digital sensors help make a 3D map of the park. This video sent to us by park officials shows Spot padding through Pompeii's alleys, navigating corners, and patrolling like a guard dog. Park officials hope Spot can help them identify vulnerable structures in Pompeii to help preserve this nearly 2,000-year-old archaeological treasure. If you're trying to imagine how Spot looks while he's cruising around Pompeii, we've got you covered. Check out our Twitter feed for pictures of the high-tech four-legged friend, headlights included. Our Twitter handle is easy to remember. We are at The World. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. The World will be right back here tomorrow.